Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 141 of Her, the podcast all about women, where we share the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and her personal space. Yeah, you heard me right. This is really going to be an extraordinary segment, and I'm really looking forward to it as well. Before we begin, just know that this episode of Her is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Complete Vitamins. They're delicious once-a-day gummies that contain the complete vitamin, mineral, folate, and omega mix, customized just for women. Trust me, you won't forget to take them because they taste so great. To learn more, go to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And here's a quick reminder to hop on over to iTunes after our episode and rate and review us, because I'm sitting here waiting to hear from you. Love your feedback. Just makes my day. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
So I'm perusing the Wall Street Journal, and I come across an article about our primal need for personal space. Boy, was that timely, because I'm having issues with personal space. People getting into mine, for instance, just saying. So in reading this, learned all about a brand new book. And this book is just fabulous. You have got to read this. Not only is it written very, very well, it's incredibly informative about the neuroscience and the evolution and human nature of personal space. It is the title of the book is The Spaces Between Us, A Story of Neuroscience, Evolution, and Human Nature. It's written by Dr. Michael Graziano, who is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Princeton University. For 30 years, he has studied aspects of brain function from sensory processing to motor control. He currently focuses on the brain basis of human consciousness, not just how we ourselves have conscious experiences, but how we perceive that others are conscious. Whew, sounds wonderful. His books include The Spaces Between Us, as I just mentioned, and Consciousness and the Social Brain. He also publishes novels, including the award-winning The Love Song of Monkey and The Divine Farce. Wow. Dr. Graziano, welcome to the Her Podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm just loving this. Now, I'm going to read something from your marvelous book. And this is under the section, The Second Skin. We all have an invisible protective bubble around us. Personal space, margin of safety, bad breath zone. I like that part especially. Duck and flinch, buffer, whatever you want to call it. We have it constantly switched on like a force field. I like to look at it like as a warp field. It comes in layers, some layers close to the skin like a bodysuit, others farther away like a quarantine tent. Oh, I just love this. So, what got you inspired to write about personal space?
Well, I have studied personal space in the lab for many years, and a good chunk of that book is about some of the experiments that we did in the lab and that led to a kind of larger understanding of the mechanisms in the brain related to it. But
what got you going into personal space per se?
Yes, like so much in science, it was a bit of an accident. We stumbled onto an interesting brain area with neurons, these brain cells that fire signals that indicate something going on in the environment. And we slowly realized these were neurons. They were like radar detectors for objects looming near the body. And that was the beginning of that whole long line of work on personal space. We just got farther and farther into it.
Oh, heck, I thought you were going to tell me you were on the bullet train in Japan and sardined in there, and you realized, oh, my God, you know, this personal space thing is a real issue here, one way or the other, don't you think? Especially with so much crowding out there and people not really having a sense that they own a little personal space of their own. I'm just sort of going to the environmental place.
Right. Well, what happened was, after I began to study this phenomenon in the brain, in the lab, it started to become very clear to me that this was not just some academic or laboratory issue, that this was fundamental, and I began to see it everywhere, on the subway, on the train, in personal interaction, in development of children, in everyday behavior. It turns out that this was not a small topic. This was one of the foundational pieces of human behavior that we tend to take for granted because we tend not to even notice it, even while it's necessary for everyday behavior.
Yet at the same time, there are people who are exquisitely sensitive to their personal space. You know the kind of people. So let's just say you're on the Acela train to from Washington, New York, something I do all the time. And then, you know, you're on one of those seats where you're sharing it with somebody else. And people are, you know, have that look about them that says, you know, don't even get near their stuff. And they almost set up like a little periphery. This happened the other day. I was in one of the single seats and I was watching what was going on across the aisle. And it was almost like someone was setting up like a fence around them. Like, you know, don't get near here and don't play with that. And, you know, when someone accidentally across the shared table actually pushed into that area a little bit, you could see the other person. I thought they were going to become homicidal. So are they just neuroscientifically more sensitive, more vigilant? What's really going on here?
Well, personal space is very flexible. And not just across people, but within one person, your personal space changes. It gets revved up, it expands, or it shrinks down depending on context. You need to shrink up your personal space when you have very intimate contact with other people. But in interacting with strangers or people you're suspicious of, that same mechanism revs up and kind of builds a larger bubble around you. So it's always changing. It's always in flux. Yes, there's vast amounts of research on how people in different circumstances or different mindsets tend to have larger or smaller personal space. So it's very easy for some people to invade your personal space because they themselves are in a confident mood and have shrunk up their own space, and they get right up close to you, and you're feeling nervous, and you kind of want to back up. So that's a very common phenomenon.
Well, you know, if we go to current issues in our culture, we've got that hashtag Me Too movement going on.
Yep.
Clearly, all about sexual harassment and abuse. And this really speaks to that because especially, you know, those in power, in this case, men, invading boundaries, violating personal space. I mean, how does the science of personal space speak to that issue?
Well, it certainly supports what's going on. I mean, men in powerful positions have small personal space. They're very willing to get right up close to people because they're not feeling threatened. And people who are not in power, who are kind of at the bottom of the power hierarchy, are going to be the people with a typically larger personal space. So you get these huge imbalances in personal space. And also, I think part of what's going on, we're sort of aware of this mechanism, but a great deal of it operates under the surface. And so you can get a real creep out feeling from another person. You can just feel totally creeped out by somebody else and not fully be conscious of the personal space mechanism working under the surface, saying, this person has violated, come a little too close. The behavior of this person is not quite socially right. You may not be able to put your finger on it. What you get is a kind of overall sense that your creep meter goes off.
Wow. Well, you know, it's interesting. People, I don't know. I think there's a gender specificity to some of this. I think that women oftentimes are more apt to give away a lot of that personal space because of that power hierarchy that has classically, you know, gone on for so long. But at the same time, you know, I think things are changing and we're becoming much more aware of basically protecting ourselves and putting up those warp shields when we need to, because a lot of this is about self-protection. I mean, it's a primal thing. Don't you see that in animals? What do you see in animals outside of humans?
Well, if I can make one comment on what you just said first, on the Me Too movement, I think one of the things that's happening is because so much social interaction has moved into cyberspace, where there is no actual literal physical space anymore between people. Some of these inequalities are going away. And this is one of the reasons, I think, one of the reasons behind the Me Too movement is men and women interact so much in a medium where there's no longer a personal space to be invaded. And this emboldens people. It allows people to speak up. It allows people to feel more democratic and egalitarian. And I'm not sure without that, the Me Too movement may not have been possible. So just to add that comment in there.
Well, I'm laughing because what is the Me Too movement, right? It's hashtag Me Too.
Yeah.
So exactly it's already right out there, right? I think your point is extremely well taken. I was just trying to put that in context here. You're right. You know, we live in so many different dimensions now. And the internet and social media per se have basically opened up a brand new world for interactions to be redefined. And in this case, personal space, well, whatever. I mean, you know, it's so interesting trying to wrap your head around this. What is personal space and how you yourself define that and how you would define violating that personal space in a big way. So you have one chapter here that I found fascinating. The peripersonal radar in humans. Can you describe that?
Right. So the backdrop of that chapter is so much of the experimental research, the science, was done on animals. And it turns out humans are not alone. Animals have a sense of personal space, a protective space toward predators, protective space toward each other. And a lot of the neuroscience of brain mechanisms was also done in animals. And so the chapter on the peripersonal space in humans, this is a whole set of research that's been going on for maybe 15 or 20 years now that's really looking at the specific mechanisms behind personal space in people, trying to take some of that earlier work from the animal literature and extending it to the human case, trying to understand what are the brain mechanisms, what's going on, how do we generate this personal space, how do we wrap it around objects in our world. We wrap personal space around the tools that we're holding. When you drive a car, you have a sense of personal space that is constructed by your brain and projected around your car. Blind people have a sense of personal space around their cane, and we wouldn't be able to use a knife and fork without extending personal space around those tools. So every aspect of our lives, of our normal human lives, it's all infiltrated by this personal space. And that particular chapter in the book describes some of the experiments, some of the ways that people have looked at personal space. And there's a whole variety of really neat, really interesting clever experiments that have been done to get at that.
So really, it's a really strong support, this issue of personal space, for survival. So, you know what your personal space is at a very primal level when you're an animal living in the wild, whether it's your cave, right, or your hole, if you're a little spider or maybe a big spider, or whatever it may be. There is a personal space, and you're vigilant, and in protecting that space, both because there may be a predator, but also there may be a competitor, maybe for the partner you have in life or whatever the issue may be. I'm just laughing and thinking of the last time I had an interaction with geese or ducks, as they were, especially geese, and swans, as they're protecting their space. It's always an ugly interaction if you get a little too close to them, because especially if there's a female sitting on eggs, and the male is, the male or the female may be out there. How about that female grizzly, when her cubs look as though they may be threatened one way or the other? There's a little personal space issue. So in humans, we certainly have that in our own really special way. You know, in your book, you talk about the experiences of your son, and he was struggling with dyspraxia. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I had studied personal space in the laboratory in a kind of an academic context for years, and I definitely did not really understand it as a human thing until I encountered it firsthand in the case of my son. And that was very difficult, what we went through. But I like to write about it and talk about it because, as I found out, ignorance is the enemy. And what happened there was he was born with dyspraxia. It's fairly common. About 1 in 20 children have this difficulty with movement coordination. And in his particular case, his variant of it, the problem seemed to be mainly organizing the space around him. He did not have a good sense of personal space. He'd bump into things, and he had trouble with a whole slew of personal space-related issues. And one of the most significant problems was just when people interacted with him. When he was very young, he was 6 years old, 5 or 6, when this really kind of came to a head in school. People couldn't put their finger on what was wrong, but the teachers found something weird about the way he bumped into people, the way he leaned too close to people, the way he seemed to touch people or slump against them in line, and it bothered them. And they found that they didn't understand that it was a dyspraxia or a personal space issue. They thought it was some kind of emotional assaultive behavior, and they kicked him out of school. And we had a it was terrible. We had a very long court battle, actually, we had a whole set of experts that said, no, we've looked at him and, diagnosed him, and he has these very basic issues, and it has nothing to do with him being misbehaving or being having any kind of emotional trouble, other than the fact that he's incredibly anxious due to the way the school treated him. We were able to get him back in school with the appropriate physical therapy that he needed for that. And he's done much better in the years since then. He's done wonderfully. You would look at him now and have no idea that there was any issue at all because of the extra training he had in understanding the visual and tactile space around him. But what we went through really showed me that when personal space goes wrong, everything goes wrong. It's so pervasive. All aspects of our lives hinge on this sense of the space, the bubble of space attached to your body, that you organize all your world, especially your social interactions, with that. And when that goes wrong, everything goes wrong, and people can react sometimes in very cruel ways. But boy, that was straight from the laboratory to real life. And I think I finally understood that this topic is real. This is something that engages all of us all the time.
Isn't that interesting? What stimulates us and motivates us, inspires us to do research, especially something so close to home. So many of us have this issue. Who've done research in our career. And my heart goes out to you because I know that must have been a very, very difficult time in your life, especially as you're advocating for your young son. And it makes me very happy to know that he's doing much better right now. So A+. And you know something, I guess it was Einstein who said, in the midst of difficulty lies opportunity. And you ran with it to be able to try to understand what all of this looks like in your studies as you were delving into purpose and meaning behind personal space per se. You know, as a neuroscientist, neuropsychologist, can you take 5 seconds now and just explain how the brain keeps track of personal space? How does it do that? Let's just, you know, like we're in the brain right now. What's happening?
All right. What we find is that there's a set of brain areas, like a network of brain areas, some of them more on the sensory end, and they're receiving input from the eyes and from the skin, and some of them more on the movement output end, and they're sending information out to the spinal cord, which controls the limbs. But these areas, these particular areas, monitor the space around the body. And so if you cue into a single neuron, a single brain cell, you can measure the activity of that one brain cell in one of those areas. You'll find that cell has a kind of a bubble of space that it monitors. And it might be, for example, a bubble 10 inches wide attached to the left side of your face, of your left cheek, for example. And any object that looms into that area of space, and especially if it touches the skin on your face, that will cause that particular neuron to fire like crazy. So the neuron's like a radar or almost like a Geiger counter. It clicks, and the clicking goes at a very high rate, 200 clicks per second if it's really revved up. To indicate, yes, there's something there. Yes, there's something in the part of space I monitor. And so these different neurons monitor different areas of space attached to different parts of your body. Some monitor space only within a few inches. Some neurons monitor giant bubbles of space that stick out a few yards from your body. And collectively, they keep track of where objects are around your body through sight, through touch, through sound, and even memory in the dark. When you turn the lights out, these neurons keep firing if there's a memory of an object near that part of your body. And so collectively, without you having to consciously participate, this is all under the surface. These neurons are constantly firing away, keeping track of the environment around you. And they're activity then feeds into movement control and biases and nudges our behavior. So it prevents us from crashing into the door frame when we walk through the door, or it prevents us from getting too close to that person who's right in front of us. And it keeps us safe socially. It keeps us safe physically. And that's just a constant process at every moment during your waking life that system is constantly active, constantly keeping you safe one way or the other. So that seems to be what's going on in the brain. It's one of the best understood systems in the brain, all the way from sensory input to movement output.
How fascinating. So you've literally got a radar going for all intent and purposes. And it's almost like you've got a level of vigilance, sometimes hypervigilance on the part of these neurons. And I suppose even they get a chance to be able to rest while you sleep. Do you notice a huge difference in the firing during sleep?
Well, we have not tested during sleep, although sometimes when you get your volunteers and you put them in the MRI scanner to measure brain activity, sometimes they do fall asleep when they're not supposed to. But because these neurons are so activated by intruding inputs, intruding objects, I would imagine that they're absolutely silent during sleep, unless you're dreaming about something intruding toward you. So, yes, I think that as long as there's nothing looming toward you, these neurons are relatively silent. But in almost all aspects of life, I mean, just sitting at a desk, moving your arm around, reaching for this or that, you somehow magically avoid bruising your arm on the edge of the desk. And we don't even think about that. It's totally automatic. But the reason for that is because this system that's constantly keeping track of where the edge of the desk is and just nudging your movement just enough to make sure you don't crash on the edge of the desk. So during normal waking behavior, it's always active, even in these very simple contexts. And without it, we'd really be in trouble.
Huh. Fascinating. I just absolutely love this. And one can only imagine how all of this feeds into the stress system in the brain when you have invasion of that personal space on a routine basis for a multitude of reasons, lots of which may involve abuse and lack of any real meaningful personal space to be able to call your own, you know, again, the overcrowding situation, throwing everybody into one room, you know, to live and back and forth. I just find this quite fascinating. So both on a social level as well as on a scientific level, on a neuroscience level, I just find this extremely compelling. All I can tell you is that I just love the book. I'm sorry, but I'm a fangirl here. So we have been talking to Dr. Michael Graziano. He is the author of The Spaces Between Us, A Story of Neuroscience, Evolution, and Human Nature. To learn more about his work, you can go to princeton.edu/Graziano. That's Graziano. Most importantly, grab the book. I thoroughly enjoyed this episode, Dr. Graziano, and I know that my podcast listeners out there have learned a heck of a lot. Just stay out of my personal space. That's all I can say. Just saying.
Well,
Dr. Graziano, thank you for being on the Herb Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Excellent. And keep up this fabulous work. I want another book out of this. All right. Now, everyone out there, remember to catch every episode of Her. Just hit subscribe on iTunes or on our show page at RadioMD.com. And now, right now, take a moment and rate and review this podcast on iTunes, because I'm waiting to hear from you. Your feedback is golden. Forget that. It's platinum. I'm Dr. Pam Peek. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or on Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And you can also check out our Her Show page at RadioMD.com for all of our past episodes. Thanks for listening and stay well.